Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode, the second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
All right.
And now he's, my brain goes semi-dead.
Yes.
Let's talk about the economy for a little bit. Bring things up to speed. There are several forces in the economy that are going on. And I want to precede this by saying something. The yield curve is dramatically inverted. That's the headline. And it's true. And in the last 40 years or so, and because we haven't always been able to track the yield curve because we haven't always had one, yield curve severe inversions, and we got what's called a severe inversion now with a 20-year Treasury bond lower than it's ever been before in history, below 2%. We've always had a recession within 18 months. Now, does that mean we're going to have one in the future? No, it just means we've always had a recession within 18 months. But there's something missing from the elements right now. The manufacturing is slowing down. As a matter of fact, manufacturing output is reported from the Labor Department to have dropped 4.4% it was the ISM that reported it. Dropped 0.4% in July. And it's down for the last since October. Manufacturing has been decelerating, slowing down.
Yeah, housing starts, which are a leading indicator.
Right.
This is going forward, not looking back. Housing starts declined 4% in July,
but retail sales jumped upward by 0.7%. Now, what's all this mean? And we got an inverted yield curve. That means there's a recession coming. We're missing an element here. If we're going to have a bear market, we're missing an element that's classic, and that is irrational exuberance. There's a great deal of fear, and bull markets climb a wall of worry. And historically, now there's no guarantee this is going to happen. I'm not making a market forecast here. But it's important to recognize that historically, we go through a fear episode that causes the market to do pretty much what it's doing. And then it somewhere between 12 and 33% rise on the backside without earnings going up. So that element hasn't showed up yet. And no guarantee it will, but that's the historic element that's missing. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Hey, I'm sorry if you covered this already, but my question is, back in the 30s, the 1930s, gold was confiscated by the government.
Yep. Right.
Could this happen again? And are coins exempt from this?
Okay.
Those are my two questions. I'll hang up and listen to your answer on the radio.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Could it happen again?
The reason why, let's say why it happened first. We were on the gold standard. The entire developed world had made an agreement that they would fix the price of gold, that all the governments of the developed nations would say this is the price of gold going forward. And a lot of the currencies were backed in gold or in silver. In order to control the price of gold, you have to control gold. That's something that when people talk about going back to the gold standard that they miss. If you have bullion, if you have gold that is not in coin form, it needs to belong to the government in order for it to be currency.
In order for the gold standard to work.
In order for any currency to work, it needs to belong to the government. The government says they will buy it from you, period.
By the way, one of Trump's nominees to the Federal Reserve believes we should go back on the gold standard, which implies the federal seizure of all gold.
Yes. So that,
which I don't think would actually be legal to do today.
It would have to be done in the same manner it was done before, which is when they seize it from you, they've got to pay you the market value. Well, now the market value has been set by the government for the gold. And usually they've done it relatively reasonably, but sometimes not so reasonably. So that could it happen again? If we go back on the gold standard, the government would be required to control the supply of gold in our nation. Now, there's another problem with that in that the number one mining country in the world right now is China. Russia's way up there on the list. South Africa's way up there on the list. If they pull up a lot of gold It's going to disrupt our currency. Our buying value will drop.
If we were on the gold standard.
If we're on the gold standard. If we grab one of those asteroids that are up there, any one of the many that are known to hold lots of gold, our currency would become extremely devalued. We would have runaway inflation. And that's a problem when you can't control the supply. That's why the government was seizing gold back then. And they still had a problem in that the reason why we stepped off the gold standard is the leader of France at the time, de Gaulle, who was still upset over being misinformed on the D-Day invasion, gathered up lots and lots and lots of United States dollars that were backed by gold and silver and presented them all at once to the U.S. Treasury and said, I want my gold and silver, please. That would have completely denuded the vaults of the United States of gold and silver. Sir Richard Nixon said, oh, we're not on the gold standard anymore.
And very frankly, even at the current price of gold, around a little less, around $1,500, there's not enough gold in the world to replace the dollars. And just not enough gold in the world to do it. And the end result is the fact that we would wind up, if we went on the gold standard today.
We would have deflation. Our dollars would be worth a lot more, which would mean everybody would get a pay cut.
And deflation is the predecessor of
depressions.
Depression, which is the predecessor of world wars. So it was probably a good idea to avoid that. People talk about going, anyone who, and it really bothers me that one of President Trump's nominees to the
one of his
Federal Reserve.
The past two that were both rejected were both gold standard folks.
There's one of them that's still on there, and she, Shelton is her name.
Oh, yeah.
She is, in my humble opinion, somewhat insane, and also a proponent of going back to the gold standard for no reason that anybody can imagine other than the fact that it sounds good.
Now, having said all of that, and we've got to say something else about gold. I ended the hour last hour comparing bubbles. Anytime you have a bubble where you've got more people or near the majority of people buying something not to use it but to sell it. This happened in 2006 and 2007 with real estate. Most of the houses being purchased in that big bubble part were not as primary residences, even though they were checking that on the mortgage application. It was as a second home somewhere. Or a third home somewhere, or a fourth home somewhere. They weren't doing it to use it. They were doing it to sell it for a profit. And that's the standard state of gold. The Bitcoin is a great example of this. When the Bitcoin was first made, everybody that had Bitcoins used them. They were using them to buy things. It was a very limited number of things that you could buy with it. But you were making they were making transactions. Then the price of Bitcoin was going up because more people wanted to use them to do transactions, which, just as a side note, made the transactions more difficult because the fluctuations in the Bitcoin caused you to not really know what you were about to spend for a pizza. You may have been spending some of your invested money or a lot of your invested money or not very much at all on any given moment, and there's really no rhyme or reason to it. So it was getting harder and harder to actually use it. And more people were getting involved because they just saw the upward trend. The same's true in emus and ostriches. You know, we had this big explosion of value in emus and ostriches in the 1990s. And it was based on this a whole series of studies on cholesterol and how the emu eggs and ostrich eggs were lower in cholesterol. We now realize that cholesterol has very little to do in the food with actual heart health. But at the time, it was the commonly held belief. So everyone says, well, we need to do emus and ostriches. They produce these really, really healthy eggs. They're really big. You can have one egg instead of a dozen eggs. It represents the same amount of protein. Until the eggs started being purchased and the emus started getting purchased not to use as eggs but to sell to somebody else who could make more eggs with them so that they could then sell to somebody else. And it caused the price of emu eggs to get up to the $1,000 mark, which is a very expensive omelet. And that's the end of my bubble rant.
I wanted to issue a correction. Last week we reported, and we got it from good sources, that the temperature at the peak of the ice sheet in Greenland had risen above freezing, which was a big deal.
Yeah.
And it turned out it didn't actually rise above freezing.
Right.
It turned out that their sensors were buried in snow and got too warm. Actually only rose to negative 2 degrees Celsius. Just still didn't rise, didn't fall below freezing. But that didn't change the report from the Danish weather agency that the ice cap has broken all previous records for melt this year.
Yeah, there's some pretty amazing overhead imagery that shows the ice cap shrinkage over Greenland over a several decade period, and it is really hard to say it's not happening.
Another thing, a more practical use for some people, the guy who identified several years before Madoff finally acknowledged that he was running a Ponzi scheme, that Madoff was running a Ponzi scheme. He did a lot of analysis, and he came to the conclusion that there's no way that Madoff's fund could have made as much money as he claimed it made. It's just not possible.
Right.
He has now come out with a new revelation. And whether or not it's true, he has a conflict of interest, but it sounds true to me. And that is that General Electric is in financial trouble that it's not admitting because of its long-term care insurance obligations, which, by the way, it tried to sell really, really hard several years ago, and nobody would buy them. The long-term care insurance companies they own, when you look at what's happening with life expectancies, cost of long-term care, and the number of people who are going into long-term care and needing that long-term care insurance, what the guy, Harry Markopoulos, the guy that the movie was basically about, The Big Short, came out with, no, that's a different guy. Different movie.
Yeah, different movie.
Anyway, the point is he has said that GE is facing potential, and I'm not joking here, this is serious, potential bankruptcy because of long-term care insurance reserves that it needs to accumulate that it doesn't have. And what does that mean to you? Well, okay, if you own GE, it may or may not mean anything. It may or may not be true. But there's a trend here that's very, very, very important if you have long-term care insurance, and that is it's not very viable, and you should be setting aside reserves just in case your long-term insurance company folds.
Now, let me explain that. I'm going to get to the basics of this. Insurance works because catastrophes don't happen very often. I think everybody can agree with that. Your insurance rates go up if you're driving your car and you happen to have lots of catastrophes. You'll notice that they're going to look at you as not a statistical average anymore. They're going to say you're one of the outliers and we're going to charge you more money. But as a whole, most of us are charged based on the fact that we don't have a lot of accidents. Insurance companies would not be able to make a profit on car insurance if everyone had accidents of catastrophic nature as a it's going to happen sort of situation. They say you're unlikely to be in a catastrophic accident at this point in your life, and that's why the rates are what they are. That's kind of the way insurance works. Life insurance. You think, what about life insurance? Everybody's going to die, right? Yes, but most people that buy life insurance don't have the life insurance when they die. That I know that's a big shocker to most people, but most people die in their late old age when they no longer need insurance. So they paid their whole life for their life insurance. It's a good thing to have to prevent really financial stress on your family. But if you aren't going to create financial stress on your family by dying, you don't need the life insurance. So the life insurance company got to keep all of that as profit over the years. All your premiums went to them. They got to keep it. That's cool. Long-term care is not the same thing. Long-term care is a lot like health insurance, only it's health insurance for a very real event that we can all pretty well expect to happen. If you don't die from some other means, read that this is the profitability motive in insurance. They don't expect you to die from other means. They expect you to get rid of the insurance before you die on life insurance. They're making the reverse bet. They're expecting you not to live, to be old enough to collect your life long-term care insurance. And people are not meeting that expectation. Long-term care insurance is very, very problematic right now. People have been promised specific rates, but just listen to this rate structure. That's a real rate structure that I've seen over the past couple of decades. Someone's being charged $116 a month over the last 10 years for their long-term care insurance. They're expected in the next 2 or 3 years to go into long-term care, which could last easily longer than the collection period. It could be another 10 or 15 years in long-term care at $3,000 a month. That's the average cost right now. You cannot pay $150 a month and expect to use the same number of payments at a $3,000 a month amount and expect that insurance company to make a profit. So there are a lot of insurance companies that are obligated to pay this stuff, but they're trying to figure out where they're going to get the assets to do it with. And that's what we're talking about here. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I called before about the question on about gold. There's two questions. You answered the first one. I appreciate that. The second one question was, does that apply to coins?
Right.
And like collector coins, does that also fall under confiscatable gold?
If it is a currency of a nation, either the United States or some other nation, they don't confiscate, or they haven't confiscated that.
If they were doing this, let's say the $20 gold piece that's worth, I don't know, a whole bunch more than $20 today.
It's like $1,300.
Could they recall currency? Yes. I mean, that is something the United States government has absolutely no question. And they will pay you $20 for that $20 gold piece.
Yeah, which could be a problem.
The United States can recall currency at any point.
Okay. All right, sir. I appreciate that info.
All right.
And it's, you know, it's kind of funny. It's an emotional attraction that people have for gold.
Right. It's almost a religion. It really, there are people that have been told by their parents or maybe their parents' parents that gold is where you go when there's difficulty. And in the Great Depression, it was true.
And it's just like that thing that they're not making any more real estate, so real estate you can always make money in. Tell
right.
that to the literally hundreds of thousands of people who lost, in some cases, everything they had, in all their savings, to the housing collapse in 2008
right.
and 9.
They're really... in the United States, even, they are making new real estate. People go, huh? Well, did you know about the volcano and the big island of Hawaii? They're making new real estate out there.
There was an article this morning in Barron's on that. Good one. FHA is now eased up on the requirements to get a condo loan with 1.5% down.
Right.
Condos
are built in the sky.
So we are creating effectively more real estate in the United States.
Converting air into land.
I would not recommend buying a condo, by the way. The risk levels get pretty steep because something can happen to the whole building and destroy your property necessarily insured.
If you're in a good insured position in a condominium in a good location that you're going to be living in, or you're in the business of doing real estate management, there's a lot of reasons you could make a profit doing this, but doing it in just I'll hold that and see what happens, it should get more valuable.
Apparently.
That's probably not a good idea.
And this is anecdotal. When we were down at Port Aransas, we were asking about this, about condos, because they were some of the buildings that are just now getting rebuilt from the hurricane. And they said a lot of the people who had condos and those things did not get insurance payments.
That's right.
And the reason was that there were exclusions from flood damage. And we think, I'm on water
storm
damage.
Surge, yeah.
Well, not just a storm surge. I'm on the fifth floor. There's no danger of flood damage. Well, in fact, what happened is the heavy rains caused the roofs to collapse, and the water just went down through there. So the people who owed, you know, sometimes a couple of $100,000 on a condo down there that they were renting out, and they thought this is a good investment,
right,
lost it all. They still owe the mortgage. And they still have to pay the mortgage, or else declare bankruptcy and give up an awful lot of stuff. Or, I mean, the bottom line to it is their insurance didn't cover it. And condos, inherently, and this came out in the article in Barron's too, condos are inherently more risky than a single-family dwelling.
And just as a side note, I've heard this probably in the last 3 weeks. I've probably heard it three different times from pretty astute people that have never done it before but are interested. And they're saying, well, why don't I go and get an investment property in Port Aransas or down on the beach? And I said, have you looked at the prices? Because you're not the only one saying that right now. There are a lot of people doing that right now. And the first reaction is, oh, then it must be a good idea. No, usually following the crowd is a bad idea in an investment process. Usually being at the head of the crowd makes sense, which means that if you had purchased this property back in 2009, you may have a massive increase in value and able to turn around and sell it for four times what you paid for it. But that's part of the reason why people are being attracted to that area right now, is because they look back and see this tremendous income or this tremendous gain in appreciation. Well, you don't get in at the top. That's kind of one of the rules of investing. Buy low, not high. And that's what's going on, is that we're seeing a bit of a bubble along the coast, the Texas coast at least, but also in California and along the East Coast. There is a bubble on coast property.
It's a good thing to remember, and it's hard to deal with. And that is, if some organization is paying people a lot to sell something, that means the organization, which has the intent of making money, thinks the smartest thing to do is to sell whatever that is.
Right.
Whether it's gold or what are condos or whatever, or flipping houses or whatever. The organization thinks selling is a really good idea, so you should buy. Think about that just a moment. That means that if they're trying to sell it real hard, they think we can make a lot of money selling this if we can find enough suckers to buy it. And that, unfortunately, is a reality. People don't talk about their losses very much, so you hear more about their gains. But buying a condo, let me give you an example here. Buying a condo without finding some way to make improvements in the condo means that you're buying something, and without adding utility to it, as it deteriorates over time, you expect to make more money when you sell it. Now think about that just a minute.
Yeah. And somebody might say, well, I'm going to rent it out for income. Well, if you understand what you're doing, it could work out. But one of the problems is that people see that as income. They get their rental check and they say, hey, I paid this much on mortgage and I got this much in income. And
in many cases,
great.
Get a tax write-off.
And they get, yeah, and they say, this is fantastic. The problem is that repairs have to happen and upkeep has to happen, or the whole thing comes down, or your rent comes down.
And if you go into a new condo that's just been built and you look around and say, that's pretty cool, then go find one that's 30 years old.
And say, this is a fascinating
term. Which means it has deteriorated over the 30-year period.
The word mortgage, think of how it's spelled. Mort, gauge. Mort means death. Gauge means expectancy or measurement. Death measurement or death expectancy. A 30-year mortgage means that they expect that home value, if no money is put into it for upkeep, the actual improved structure will be valueless at the end of 30 years.
It's important to remember that the IRS doesn't like to give away money.
You can say that
Congress.
A few. Can you put that in bold and underline it? The IRS is not a friendly, have some money type organization.
They allow you to depreciate the entire value of a rental real estate property over a 30-year period, which means the IRS is of the opinion that over a 30-year period, a piece of rental property deteriorates to being worthless.
Now, if you're keeping it up, if you're putting money into it to replace carpeting, to make good tile in there, to paint it regularly, to make sure that the leak's not there, you still don't have control in a condo of the rest of the building.
Right.
You need to have a good agreement on that as well.
But not only a good agreement, what if the condo management organization goes under?
Yeah.
Well, nobody is now cleaning up around the condo. Nobody is painting. Nobody is fixing things that they've agreed to fix.
I've had clients in that situation.
And
it's having seen enough of this, When it comes to condominiums, I am of the opinion that you shouldn't be involved in a big collective investment unless you have some vote in the collective and some method of knowing what happens if that collective organization goes away. We spent a lot of time on that, but this is a pretty important set of information. This is another thing. Let me throw this in just to, I think this could wrap it up unless you have more. One of the things that I tell people, you know, clients, they say, hey, I want to buy a jet ski. I really have always wanted to buy a jet ski. Well, what I tell them to do, first I say, do you want it new? And they say, well, it doesn't really matter as long as it works. I want a jet ski that's working well. And they're usually telling me this in a given season. Can you guess what season it is that they're telling me that they want a jet ski?
Dead of winter.
Yeah, well, generally not.
Ah.
Yeah. I tend to get this thought that, hey, I'm going to get jet skis. They're not as expensive as a boat. They're a lot of fun. I can zip around on the water in the middle of summer. What I tell them is if you really want it, wait till winter to buy it.
Right. And buy last buy year's
it, right. Buy model. It in February and not even – just make sure it's a good quality model. Look for reviews online and see which ones have held up the best. And then look online in the middle of February for a jet ski. The same thing happens in oil. This is a very interesting concept. Eduardo Saverin. Do you know that name? It's kind of an unknown name. He was one of the two founders of the Facebook before it was Facebook. He's the guy that came up with the initial money to pay Mark Zuckerberg to not go to school. The way he did it is by trading oil futures. He recognized something interesting. If you buy heating oil in the summer and you sell it in the winter, you can make a profit. So he arbitraged. That's the word. He used arbitrage to buy heating oil when people don't need to heat their houses, have it stored, and sold it at a good profit when people needed it to heat their houses. So if you're going to buy a condo or you're going to buy something on the coast, don't buy it when everybody else wants to buy it if you expect to make a big profit. Wait till everybody else wants to sell. And Sir John Templeton is one of my heroes. We say bull markets climb a wall of worry because he said it. He said bull markets are born on pessimism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. So we're not seeing euphoria right now. That's a good thing. The last quote, though, is he said, I believe in being a conscientious investor. When the rest of the market wishes to sell, I oblige them and buy. When the rest of the market wishes to buy, I oblige them and sell. And that is the definition of what investors should be thinking, not everybody's buying, I should too. First, if you want to buy something because it sounds like a good idea, where'd you hear it from and how many other people are doing it right now? What's happened to the thing? Are you getting in at the top end or even way above the bottom? Then it may be better to look around for another idea. And we have some pretty big opinions on what those ideas should be.
We also have some commercials we need to play.
Yes, we do. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. I'm Jake, and this guy over here is
Jeff.
And we will be back on the other side. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. We still got a lot of stories to talk about. Among other things, the U.S. budget deficit, which doesn't get talked about very much.
Yeah. We're on track for another $1 trillion year, 1.38 for 2019.
We have already exceeded, at this early date, the total deficit for last year, and it's getting worse. If we go into a recession, which I think is a very high probability in the next 2 years, the budget deficit will get considerably worse. That is something that amazes me I know a lot of people who are diehard Republicans, who are claim to be conservatives and who were deeply, deeply, deeply concerned about the budget deficit in the previous administration, who now seem to think running a deficit that's considerably larger than the one that was run in the previous administration is a wonderfully good idea. I really don't understand the switch in position, but I guess that's the way it is. And I have had yet to have anybody, and I've asked again and again, somebody please give us a call and explain why it's a really, really, really good idea to run huge deficits now, and it was a really, really, really bad idea 4 years ago to run huge deficits. I'm not taking a side on this. I'm just amazed at the ability of both parties to say it doesn't make any difference how much money you borrow.
Right.
It's a little bit frightening. As long as interest rates are critically low, that's fine. But in the next, in the recovery, on the other side of this recession that we, the cyclical recession that inevitably it will come, interest rates will probably go up. And when they do, we're going to have to pay the piper. And I guess from the president's point of view, it's beyond his, even his second term, that the big impact will hit. So I guess it's a big deal. But it just makes me feel a little uncomfortable. Some other things that are going on out there. Jake mentioned housing starts fell 4% in July.
That's mostly based on multifamily homes, which are mostly investment type vehicles. So we actually had a rise in single family home starts. It's a small rise, but it's a rise. So it's a mixed signal, just like a lot of the leading signals are being mixed right now. The indicators are saying, well, sort of okay in the future, but not great. So we have a slight negative based on less investment going on in the home start area.
We don't, another subject. We don't normally pay a lot of attention to consumer surveys about how consumers feel about the economy and how they feel about things, because they commonly behave differently than the surveys indicate. But there's one that came out from the University of Michigan this week. It was pretty fascinating, because what we have is an economy where manufacturing is slowing down, exports are slowing down, trucking is in a recession. You start down the list of all the things that are the leading drivers in the economy, and they're all negative except one. And that is consumer spending. Consumer spending jumped 0.7%, which is a huge jump for 1 month. But the University of Michigan survey had a really interesting thing. Now, they admittedly, the index dropped from 98 to 92, which means that the current view of consumers about the economy has declined, but they're spending more. When asked why are you spending more, their response was that they are trying to buy things quickly before the prices go up because of tariffs. This explains the surge in consumer spending very nicely. It also explains why a lot of people have remained employed, because there's a lot of consumer spending and manufacturers are waiting on the effect of that to come back up so they can increase their manufacturing again. They don't want to lay off people if this is a temporary downturn. But the important thing that I took out of that is, and by the way, one other number there, the view of the future by consumers dropped to 82, which is not good, since it was in the upper 90s at the beginning of this year, and now it's dropped to 82 and it's still going downhill. The fact is, Walmart and other places have acknowledged now that if the 10% tariffs go into effect on about half of the 300 million that was previously scheduled, it will have an impact on prices at the retail level, and there'll be a lot of things it has price it's going to have an impact on.
Yeah.
And when we really won't know until we look at September, all of September's data, which will be deep into October. Right around then, we'll have some idea what's going on, and by November, we'll have a better idea of what's going on because of these tariffs, if they go into effect. And about that time, we'll be looking at December 15th for the second round of tariffs to hit. So there's a case of we don't know, but one thing we can say is that the retailers have said they don't have enough margin to absorb tariffs in the future, and they're going to have to just raise prices. And if the price of everything, well, half the stuff in Walmart went up 10%, would that affect your buying things in Walmart or wherever you buy things? And I think it probably would.
I tend to agree with that. I think that is a very major statement there. We're starting to see inflation tick up. We're seeing a drop in investment. So for all of 2018, last year, the entire year, residential investment was down by just over 4%. For this year, so far, each quarter has been down. That's just a sign of a mature economy. We've done a lot of residential investment over the past decade. There's less happening now because the demand for it's lower, because there are fewer people buying houses now. You don't want to keep building houses when people are buying fewer houses. So we're seeing these little signs pop up. We're still in growth. The Conference Board, they're the folks that put out the economic outlook and their leading lagging economic indicators. I recommend people checking them out. People ask us where we get our data. This is conference-board.org. Head out there and you'll see lots of information. If you're like us, you will giggle with glee when you look at it, but most people will immediately start drooling on their keyboard and possibly sleep on the keyboard, which could be problematic. Anyway, what they are saying is that they're expecting for this year an average growth for our economy of around 2%. That is the consensus from the Conference Board. Looking ahead, it's harder with what they're looking at, but we've got a lot of headwinds that might shift, a lot of bumps that might get smoothed out if the trade war is somehow resolved, so that tariffs aren't being slung both directions all the time. And when I say both directions, quite often we're referring to China in the trade war, but China is not the only country that we're having a trade war with. We're having a trade war with the majority of the world right now. And that means if we get some resolution just with China, things will improve. If we get resolution on the trade war in general, we'll have huge prospects into the future. That might extend us, that we might use this as the next boost to go forward another couple of years without a recession. But there's no real sign of that happening. We have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Connor in Coppers Cove.
Hi, Connor.
I heard just last couple of days that President Trump put out a little feeler there about buying Greenland.
Yes, he did.
Multiple feelers, yeah.
That's his strategy, lower interest rates and buy Greenland.
Yeah, it'll be a good mortgage rate for that.
That was in Barron's this morning.
Yeah, it's what was your question on it?
Okay, my question is, what do you think of, is there any viability whatsoever considering our debt?
No.
No.
First off, it's not for sale.
Yeah, it has more to do with the fact that Denmark doesn't want to sell it.
You say it's not for sale, but I mean, I've heard of things like that before. Not for sale, not for sale. Right,
well,
there's a population in Greenland. There's about 56,000 people that live there.
I understand that. The Dutch own it, and they have to pay, what is it?
The Dutch don't own it.
The Danes own it.
Okay.
Denmark owns it.
Well, let me say another thing, though. Our use of Greenland for our military is unrestricted.
Or we already have agreement then.
Yeah, right. The Danes said you can use this to your heart's content for your military. And we do. The northernmost military installation of the United States is in Greenland.
Yeah, what I was thinking about is more like you were talking about how much mineral wealth there is.
Well, there.
Could we?
You'd have to get through the ice,
and that is not an easily.
Well, I thought they said the ice was melting.
Well, it is, but.
But if you have to get through the ice, then why do you say you have to get through the ice?
Well, this is an important factor. The ice is melting, and you know what regulations the United States have on mining when you've got groundwater melt. That's the point. The melting ice is, if you're doing metal mining, heavy metals get in the water. And we've got laws in place. So it's the same reason why we do most of our iron mining somewhere else.
There's nothing that would stop a corporation from mining those materials.
As it stands currently.
As it stands today, and they don't for a very good reason. There's this huge sheet of ice sitting on top of Greenland, and it's moving. So you have to dig through the ice to get to the minerals. And the thing you dig through is moving. In some places, it's moving at jerky speeds, and there's a lot of water running underneath it. The cost of getting to those minerals would be absolutely prohibitive. There's another issue, though, that's even bigger.
Isn't that all that, most of that ice, or all of it, freshwater?
It is.
It is, all of it, yeah.
Okay, well, we just melt it down and pump it over to desert areas.
Well, that'd be a little hard. The nearest desert is several thousand miles away across the ocean.
And the reality is a corporation could do that today. There's nothing that the United States owning it wouldn't make it easier to do that.
I didn't say it'd make it easier. It'd be more profitable.
Well, Denland, an important thing to remember, Greenland is an autonomous state of Denmark. And it'd be kind of like us, maybe we didn't, the president decided he didn't like Florida, so he would sell Florida.
Well, no, I think that's a lot of difference.
Well, the point is that
Florida's an autonomous state. It's got its own government. It regulates itself for the most part.
That is monetarily controlled by another government.
No, not really.
Yeah, they are.
State governments are not monetarily controlled by the federal government.
How much money do the Danes give them each year? I heard something like
About $500 million a year it costs them to have it. But the other point of that's a questionable number because there's money that comes back to it. But this is the point. It is part of Denmark. It is an intrinsic part of Denmark.
It's been a part of Denmark for almost 1,000 years.
The entire population of Denmark is against selling it, and the entire population of Greenland is against selling it. And if we took over Greenland's constitution, and it has one, forbids the private ownership of land. It would be in direct contradiction to the United States Constitution. We would have to invade Greenland and either evict or place under gunpoint the 56,000 people that are there. And I don't think that would go over real well.
Here's the other thing, though. This is tongue-in-cheek. If we buy Greenland, the border moves. Is it illegal immigration if the border crossed you?
Well, considering the way things are now, it looks like it doesn't make much difference.
Right.
So the point is, it is the whole issue. I know the president would like to buy Greenland. It was reported that he told his staff that they wanted him to look into Greenland because it put his name in the history books. But
there's no real benefit.
Alaska, for example, when it was purchased, was for sale. It was offered, said, would you like to buy it?
And we said no the first time.
And we've tried, by the way, we have tried three times in history. The United States has attempted to buy Greenland three times in history. In all three cases, Denmark said no. And every indication is that Denmark would say no again.
They have said
no.
You
know how things go. Things change all the time, so you don't have to tell about that.
Yeah, that's certainly true. All right,
thanks for the call. And it's a fascinating thing. Why would a country buy more property? And there are good reasons to do it. There would be good reasons if you've got property that you wish to expand your population. Now, that was the majority of the reason for the expansion of the United States during the 19th century, was that this population explosion, people were having lots of kids, there was enough food to go around, and a lot of immigration was occurring. So we needed more land for all the people. Well, our population is pretty flat right now. And what's more, there's lots of land that is going back to nature in the continental United States. The rural land, if all you have to do is drive west of I-35 in Texas, go about 15 minutes west of I-35 for most of I-35, and you'll find houses with trees growing through them. Because they have left the rural and gone to the urban. Either their kids did and they passed away, or something along those lines. We're depopulating a huge portion of our country to move to big urban centers. And that doesn't imply that we're lacking in raw real estate. It implies that we're lacking in urban real estate. So it may be a good time to buy Greenland if it were for sale, just for later on. But, you know, what's the benefit of it? And that's the big question.
Well,
there's really not a good tax base there.
From a strictly practical point of view, the House of Representatives would have to authorize the money to buy Greenland.
Yeah.
And
I don't think Nancy Pelosi's going to be in.
No, I don't think that you're going to get it through the. I don't think you get it through the Senate.
Yeah, the Nancy Pelosi thing. Anything the president says, she's probably going to say no first. But even in the Senate, they're trying to deal with some other things that they consider to be important, and Greenland is not on their priority list. The fact that the president's talking about it is intriguing. It's fascinating, and may not have any weight whatsoever. He may not even think about it again for the next 3 years.
Yeah, well, at any rate, it's kind of a non-entity.
We're about out of time. I bet you have some things that you can take us through the wrap-up.
I do.
What can we do today?
Well, I want to tell you about a couple of things to be aware of that could cause a stock market panic, that are very real and could, and if they happen, ignore them. Number one, Brexit is probably going to happen on a no-deal basis on October 31st. You say, what's it got to do with this? Well, the United Kingdom leaving the European Union with no deal is going to create a lot of economic turbulence. We don't even know how much economic turbulence it's going to create yet, because Great Britain is an integral part of the trade system that goes on around the world. It's an integral part of the financial markets. And all of a sudden, it just ceases to exist and has no trade agreements with anybody, including the United States. And it doesn't look like they're going to get a trade agreement with the United States on a no-deal Brexit, by the way, despite what the president recently said. The Secretary of Commerce, I think, recently said. Another thing that's that you need to be aware of is Europe is headed for a recession unless they do something pretty radical.
Yeah, there's parts of Europe already in a recession, but Germany's just begun the first half of a possible recession.
Germany had a negative quarter, which means that their economy, which is based on exports, which have been disrupted rather dramatically by the trade war, are suffering pretty badly. If Germany goes into a full recession, which is entirely possible at the end of the next quarter, we'll see this. It could pull the rest of Europe into a recession, which would have a negative effect on the United States. Last but not least, it's something to be aware of. If the Chinese were to invade Hong Kong with military forces and start slaughtering people, which is an entirely possible thing to do, it's probably going to cause a panic, because Hong Kong is another center of trade and commerce with the rest of the world. All of these things are temporary items that come and go. Unfortunately, because of the trade war, we're in a position where we don't have a lot of economic reserve to deal with those things. But the important thing to remember when they occur is that they generally may cause a panic. But the United States economy is not driven by Britain. It's not driven by Germany. And it's not driven by Hong Kong or China. It's driven by you and me. And we anticipate going into the 2020s, which is admittedly looking down the road, but if you're an investor, by definition, that means long-term rather than speculator. We anticipate that the 2020s are going to be a basic repeat of the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties. We will probably have an exceptional economic boom in the United States on the other side of this recession. Is there any way to time and get out and then get back in? No. The reason I say that is nobody has ever been able to successfully do it. And when you try to do something with your and our limited expertise that some of the smartest people in the world and some of the best teams in the world have tried to do and gotten themselves smashed, I think that's probably a bad idea. It's kind of like getting on the Titanic and thinking you could make it across the Atlantic Ocean without hitting an iceberg after somebody else didn't. So there's a lot of potential problems coming. The probability, based on history, is that we're going to see a stock market run up before things turn sad and bad. And when they turn sad and bad, just grin and bear it. But as we've said before, the trick is, if you need the money, Don't be in a long-term position. Have enough money in short-term positions that you can cover needs that you have in the short term. Long-term, we're probably going to look back at the current level of the Dow Jones Industrial Average and S&P 500. We'll look back 5 years, 10 years from now and say, look how low it was back then. So it's a good idea to stay put. And that's kind of the bottom line to the strategic issue of investing.
Sounds good.
That was a good monologue.
Yeah, we're about out of time. Thank you for listening, presuming you have been listening. If you haven't been listening, well, then you can't hear me say this to you. Ha ha. Thank you for listening. We appreciate it. We generally get – this is the longest we get to talk to each other during the entire week because 2 hours of uninterrupted just being together – doesn't happen very often.
And you notice we don't get into arguments. Oh.
Yes, we do. Ha! Ha! Had to do it. Had to do it. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we actually do give personalized investment advice at a fiduciary level through our firm, The Personal Wealth Coach. You can reach that that firm with voicemail locally at
254-947-1111.
Or you can reach it toll-free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can see our made-for-radio faces, see our wonderful staff. We put our newsletter up there. We also have contact forms there. You can also email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com.